sometimes so much of my idea work, you know, happens on my own, at least physically on my own. And so, you know, a lot of it's inside my head. And so sometimes when I start to chase down an idea, I get lost. I guess really, who am I trying to kid? Every time I chase down an idea, there's some place in that process where I feel like I get lost, and sometimes very lost. And in some ways, that's disconcerting. I have a still strong childhood memory of being lost alone in the woods, and the feelings that come with it are ones that I still find distressing. I don't like feeling lost. On the other hand, as I've grown, I've come to understand that if I'm feeling lost, it might also signify that I've left this illusory but secure feeling bubble of, you know how the world works. And I've gotten out there into a much larger space, and it's a space that I can't really see the edges of. It's one that I can't fully comprehend or apprehend, and it can be big and it can be scary, but it also welcomes my most courageous and even my most outrageous explorations. The one thing I don't need to fear in that space is running out of space. And I can explore and explore and explore, and I can never see over the horizon of new possibilities. And to me, that's really exciting. I get goosebumps talking about it, like right now to my phone. So it's obviously kind of an exciting space for me. This week, what I set out to explore was the thought that the experience of a global pandemic pushes us, if not inexorably, then at least fairly assertively, toward change. And I wondered what would happen if I let, I wondered what would happen to that thought or to that exploration if I let global pandemic sort of serve as a kind of stunt double for, you know, significant unanticipated event, generally as a category, and consider what the impact of that might be on spiritual change in particular, because that's closer to the center of our community's life and work together. In other words, what can we begin to learn about exploring or changing beliefs from the significant unanticipated event that we're experiencing in this moment? My hope would be that in this context I wouldn't need the following disclaimer, but just in case, and partly also because in our Facebook community there are people whose stories I know less well than in our gathered community, I am not going to be saying that everything happens for a reason. And I am not going to be saying that God can use even the greatest suffering to teach us something we need to learn. Personally, I experience both of those ideas as unbelievable. In the first case, assuming a reasonableness about our lived experience that seems to me to be easily unseated. And in the second case, gesturing toward a notion of the divine that I find cruel, duplicitous, and untrustworthy. Also, I don't think we need either of those ideas to be people that can learn from our lived experiences. Now, having said that, I want to add that I can also see their appeal. When I feel lost, running across a paved path feels great, even if I can't see where the path might take me. So, believe away and see where it takes you, and I will try to do the same. Now, in some ways, believe away and see where it takes you could sound kind of dismissive, but I hope we will see that it's actually something of a summary of where I'm headed in my explorations today. But for starters, a few observations about change in general. If you start to research models for change, attempts to illustrate what some of our common or shared experiences might be when we're in a state of change, one of the ideas you're going to run into right away is something called Lewin's Change Management Model. And as you can probably guess from its name, it's a model for managing institutional change as opposed to personal change. If you press into it a little further, if you do follow this up, you'll fairly quickly find how people have applied it to more personal experiences, and I'll be drawing on some of that work as we go along. Now, that model, Lewin's Change Management Model, simply stated, is most commonly illustrated by the process of changing an ice cube into an ice cone. Don't get too excited, not an ice cream cone, just an ice cone. So it's changing the shape from a cube to a cone. And the process has three stages, which kind of makes sense when you think about the image that goes with them. The stages are unfreeze, change, and refreeze. Now, if your imagination works at all like mine, I'm sorry, first of all, but beyond that, you might already have some objections. For example, why refreeze? Like, I get how we can't change if we stay the same. Well, duh, right? So the need to get unfrozen from our current state is an inevitable part of changing. But if we melt down into a puddle and then refreeze into a different shape, aren't we just setting ourselves up for the same experience again in the future? Doesn't the necessity for change just keep on coming? I was listening to some new music the other day. One of the true delights of being at home a lot with our kids, who are the primary purveyors of new music in my life, is that there's lots of new music around and lots of new music ideas. And so I was listening to a new album, and the opening line of the opening song on this particular album was, "I've been praying for a breakthrough as long as everything stays the same." I've been praying for a breakthrough as long as everything stays the same. It cracked me up then, cracks me up now. A lot of resonance to that, I think. Something clearly needs to change, but I want to have that something change without disrupting the things that I want to stay unchanged. I've been praying for a breakthrough. As long as everything stays the same, we're going to be good. To put it more into the images of the change model that I was just talking about, I might even be willing to go through the meltdown of what I personally believe or hold dear, as long as I get to return to some state of new beliefs or ideas that feel equally solid and unchangeable. What I'm not interested in that set of ideas, is staying liquid. That state of staying liquid, if we were going to try to imagine what that's like, it might be one way of thinking about how frustrating we might be finding the mixed messages of social distancing and re-engagement. The feeling of which way do I jump is not a pleasant state in which to live. We seem pretty hardwired to not want to live there. And so one of the things that we do as humans, that we tend to do to avoid that sensation, is we make things that buffer us from it. We make things like relationships. We make ongoing connections with others that can provide some semblance of normalcy to our lives. And if you find yourself thinking these days, I'm about topped up on the normalcy of those I'm isolating with right now, then you've probably got lots of company, and including probably some of those same people thinking, you know, the same thing about you. So there's that. We make institutions. We form them around values or goals or outcomes that give them some focus, something we can aim at or work toward. We freeze them, essentially. And that helps us if we're managing, right? Say, here's the target, it's not moving, aim at that. And we make systems of belief. We make stories that guide our ways of relating, our search for meaning, our actions in the world. But things happen that shake those buffering systems up. Sometimes we find ourselves restless or resistant to the norms of our established relationships. Institutions can behave in self-interested or self-preserving ways. Sometimes that means they chew up people and spit them out, or they try to keep alive economic or business models that are failing to serve well people or planet. Systems of belief sometimes turn out to be inadequate to changing times or circumstances, or they reveal themselves to be institutions that, despite being dressed up in religious clothing, are still primarily self-interested and self-preserving. When we have experiences like that, we can find ourselves thinking, I need a breakthrough, you know, I need a change so I can what? So I can get back to feeling as solid as I felt before. You can sort of hear the problem, I think. Well, maybe for all the possible benefits of a change model like unfreeze, change, refreeze, maybe it's lacking a kind of necessary complexity. Maybe it's lacking a required ambiguity that's a closer match to our life experiences in a world where sweeping societal upheaval can arrive on a jet plane in the form of a dry cough and a pounding headache. That's pretty fragile. Let's move this a bit more into the realm of what I'm going to call spiritual exploration. Now, if anyone listening to this is a scholar of deconstructionist history or ideas, or if you studied deconstructionism more extensively in some particular discipline, Tim, I expect to spend some time with this in the realm of film. If you've studied this more deeply, then you may find some of my shorthand regrettable. So with my apologies to the more studied, here we go. These days, it's a pretty common thing to hear people talk about deconstructing their belief systems or their faith. And as with lots of words, the history sometimes gets discarded early on and the common usage becomes the norm. That's not necessarily a problem, but sometimes even a quick look backwards can be informative. So in this case, the very, very short version of deconstructionism is that it's a form of philosophical and literary criticism. It's built mainly on the work of the French philosopher Jacques Derrida in the 1960s. And no, I did not say that like a French person would. Again, in very simple terms, this started out as detailed examination of literary texts that show that they have no fixed meaning, but that they can be understood in different ways by each reader. Now, as with so many impactful ideas over time, what started in the lit department didn't stay in the lit department, but it rippled out into the realms of the humanities and the social sciences, which of course includes theology, our ideas about God, and our words for those ideas. Now, another way that those ideas could be stated is to say that deconstruction is the act of breaking something down into its separate parts in order to understand its meaning, especially when this is different from how it was previously understood. I think that's probably quite a bit closer to the way a lot of folks use deconstructing when they're talking about their spiritual beliefs or their faith systems. Now, to me, that sounds a bit like the thaw phase of that change model. It also sounds a lot like the way that I would describe my own spiritual journey and the spiritual journeys of lots of folks that I know, including many people at the table. And this is where I think there's an interesting intersection with the way we humans sometimes approach change, including the kinds of changes that come with exploring what we believe. When all of this deconstructionism hit the theology department, I don't know if you can imagine the uproar, maybe you can. It is quite an uproar. Largely because fundamentalist Christian theology can't tolerate the idea that religious or theological language is metaphor, because fundamentalist Christian theology's core assertion is that the word of God can be identified directly with human words, in particular those words that the institution of the church chose to be canonized in the Bible. To give ground on that assertion that human words could be identified directly with human words was not seen as equivalent to springing a theological leak. It was equivalent to blowing the whole Christian ship out of the water. And on the other side of that debate were the deconstructionists, who were arguing along with Nietzsche that what we might call truth is a collection of worn-out metaphors that have become, quote, fixed, canonical, and binding, close quote, to such a degree that we've forgotten that they were illusions in the first place. So, just take those two ideas and put them in the same room at the same time and, you know, there's a cat fight. Now, before I get lost on this particular side trail, let's bring this back to talking about exploring what we believe. If we think about that debate that I just sort of so roughly outlined, in light of the unfreeze, change, refreeze idea, we might see that it's possible to sort of thaw or deconstruct something we believe and then refreeze there in ways that don't keep exploration alive. And this is, to me, this is kind of an intriguing problem. We can end up in a place where the absolutism of fundamentalism, which insists that only one construction, which is not admitted to be a construction at all, is true, right, and good, and the absolutism of deconstructionism, which insists that all constructions are equally illusory, with none more true, right, or better than any others, and we end up with those two things pitted against one another as either or. That can happen really easily, and it happens really often. The bumper sticker version of that rather long sentence might be, you believe what I believe because it's the truth, or you're destined for eternal suffering, versus you do you, it's all good, just don't try to tell me that your good is better than my good. Same battle, different words. Now, here's where I think the interesting thing really kicks in. It's right there. It's in that it's all good, just don't try to tell me your good is better than mine, that we can potentially find the state of staying liquid, of not deconstructing just so we can refreeze in a new static state, but staying open to change and discovery. And I think that the key can be found in the idea that even if all our language for what we believe is necessarily metaphor, not the thing itself, and points as much to what is not as it does to what is, There are still some metaphors that may be more suited to a particular time, place, or circumstance than others would be. That's all I'm going to say about that. There's lots to chew on. But for example, in the realm of metaphors for God, I think we're living at a time, at least in this part of the world, where we're starting to see how metaphors that insist on patriarchalism or militarism or escapism, when we use those kind of metaphors for the divine, that can produce a present that is violent and that leaves us without language for spirituality that can serve well in a world that has the capacity to destroy itself in more ways than it ever has had before. Also, if we look for ways to bring body, mind, and spirit to the work, let's say, of caring well for the earth, an increasingly urgent and present dilemma, we need metaphors for human-divine relations as well as for human-world relations that focus on unification, on unity and interdependence rather than division and tribal identity. So those are interesting shifts, right? There's interesting things going on there. Now, part of what makes this also challenging for all of us as humans is that the systems that it's hardest for us to see are exactly the ones that we are most embedded in and dependent on. And that's just sort of categorically the case for us as humans. And that's one of the significant reasons why disruption, like the moment that we're in, can be helpful. This is one of the tenets of adult learning, in particular, in contemporary theories about adult learning, is that disruption is essential. That if we don't get disrupted, we just stay frozen in the shape of the ice cube. We never turn into the puddle, and we never even have a chance to refreeze in a different shape because we're not going anywhere. Disruption can help us thaw. Basically, it can give us the impetus we might need to reconsider the shape of something we believe or have believed that really does need to be explored or deconstructed or melted down so we can examine what it's comprised of and consider how it might be reconfigured, not forever, but for a time such as this. And that's the essential idea. Having said that, it seems that we're inclined to refreeze what we learn into the new version of what we've seen to be inadequate to our present circumstances or understanding. And when we do that, we've missed the point, which is that all of our constructs are limited and partial, and they serve us best when they're held loosely and with an eye to their constant revision and evolution, and with a courageous acknowledgement that all of them point more to what is not than they do to what is. If you like a biblical metaphor for this, I think one of the outstanding ones is the metaphor of spirit. And spirit, of course, the same as breath and wind. That these are all things where we kind of, all images that we come to as human beings in this kind of searching and go, there's a lot there that's going on that I don't understand, and yet I'm also having an experience of it that's essential, as with breath. There's something profoundly mysterious about breath. We can't cause it, but we sort of know how it works. Well, if you stop, you die, for instance. That's a big kind of knowing. But how it actually comes to be, how we live by breath, the biology of it, the chemistry of it, the biochemistry, the neurology of it, and so on, sure. The actual essence of it? Well, no. And so the things that we know point to the things that we don't know. And that's always the case. And that is something that we can learn to face with, I think, both courage and with some joy. But we have to kind of get our heads around the possibility that the state in which we will do our best exploring is the liquid state, not the refrozen one. So when we hit an idea that feels like it's an important one and it thaws something that was sort of frozen up for us in a not good way, we celebrate that, we kind of melt it down into its parts, what we often use deconstruction language for, so we can examine it and say, in this other context, from this other vantage point, what might this mean for this time, in the midst of this experience? What might be a good metaphor for this? But then instead of refreezing that new metaphor and saying, no, this is the thing, this is the thing, this is the new thing that the old thing wasn't, I'm going to park right here, I'm going to camp out with this new thing like I used to camp out with the old thing. No, that's exactly where we need to go. Oh, the lesson here is not actually the new thing. the lesson here is what I learned in the process of melting down the old thing and having it be liquid in my life, and saying in this moment, what shape might this best take? Because a new moment's coming. We know that. We're living with an unanticipated moment of epic proportions. To think that this might be the last new moment, how absurd. To think that perhaps we could freeze a system of belief or even a way of relating and say that's going to cover all the unanticipated, all the yet unimagined even possibilities of our lived experience, that doesn't seem very wise. It doesn't seem very thorough. But the alternative is that we stay liquid. Staying liquid, I think, could really just be another way of saying keep exploring. And so, as we considered earlier, if there's some encouragement that I could put into a sentence to kind of wrap this little exploration up, it would be explore away and see where it takes you. Thanks for showing up. Thanks for listening to me go on my little explore. Thanks for being explorers yourselves and for seeing where it takes you. And thank you for bringing the places where it takes you back to the community of exploration at the table. One of these days we'll get to do that in person. In the meantime, I've been so enjoying our conversations in other milieu and making the most of these times as well. So until the next time we're in touch with one another, however that happens, peace to you all. Bye for now.